Well, welcome to our second important questions evening. This time looking at the question, has science buried God? And it's an important question to consider, I think, because we live in an age where many of us consider ourselves to be committed to rational thought and evidence and proof. And we're aware of figures like Richard Dawkins using his position as a celebrated scientist to make quite a strong case for how we're now ready to outgrow God. So it's an important question for us to consider this evening. It's a question on many people's minds. Has science buried God? And in order to help us navigate this seemingly complicated relationship between science and Christian faith, I'm delighted to welcome a friend of mine, Jonathan, who's very kindly travelled down from Oxford to help us consider this question this evening. He's got some things to talk to us about for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have a short break for refreshments, use of the facilities, and then your chance to ask some questions. So as an associate professor at Oxford University, a scientist with expertise in medical statistics and clinical trials, Jonathan is well placed, I think, to help us explore what science can really tell us and how, in fact, science tells us anything at all. He's got over 200 publications in leading journals and a great many letters after his name that I was disappointed to find don't spell anything particularly amusing or rude. So, without much further ado, please join me in welcoming Jonathan up to kick off the evening.
So I'm here to speak to you a bit about the relationship between science and religion. Hugh gave the more provocative title, Has Science Buried God? But being a good scientist, I've gone for a little bit more neutral. It's my main title, which is really about science and religion. I want to start off by saying that these are my views. I haven't asked anyone's approval, not my employers, not my churches. So please do bear that in mind. And then in the field that I come from, research, but all kind of research really, increasingly it's important to declare where you're coming from. So I'm associate professor in one of the departments of Oxford University. It's called the Department of Musculoskeletal Sciences and Rheumatology, but we all call it ENDORMS for short because it's quite a mouthful. My own background is actually a statistician, which is basically the science of data, or uncertainty probably is what we spend a lot of time focusing on. It's our role often to explain to other scientists how little they actually know, how little their experiment has actually achieved. A little bit about my background. You may be picking up a Scottish accent. If you are, that's correct. I am Scottish. I was born up north in Dundee, city of Dundee, if that's familiar to anyone. I brought up in a Christian home about 30 minutes north of their drive, studied in Aberdeen University, undergraduate in statistics, and then through that got an opportunity to do a PhD looking at what we call learning curves, about surgeons' learning operations and how you deal with that, and research studies was my topic. Also studied in Aberdeen and then moved into doing research in that area. At the time it was more what we would call applied medical research, and more about the healthcare, so about research helping work out how you should be treated or how the doctor should interact to you or the nurse or the health professional for various diseases. And that is still predominantly what I work in, but more recently I've got a little bit more involved in what is often called the basic sciences, or more what people think of as sometimes proper science, things that involve, you know, test tubes, things that involve kind of fancy pieces of equipment and such like, sort of other areas sort of impinging on kind of molecular biology and things like that, and also a little bit in what we call sometimes translational medicine, which is really trying to take findings from the laboratory through towards the patient. And so it's trying to bridge that gap from lab and patient. I've done a bit more research in that area as well. In terms of my personal view on religion or not, I'm a Christian and I would hold to what might be described as a historic view on Christianity. What I want to talk about is using these sort of questions and headings. Think about what religion is, what science is, what religion is, and then are the two compatible together? And then just make some concluding thoughts related to that. And you've already alluded to this, but it's not very hard to find quite provocative and quite different views on the interaction of science and religion. These actually are two people, eminent scientists who have Oxford links. So just in case you think people from Oxford know the answer, clearly they don't, because these two clearly disagree greatly on the topic at hand. One says Peter Atkins, who's a physicist, eminent physicist, says science and religion cannot be reconciled. That is his bold statement. Whereas John Houghton, who is a climatologist, these both men are of a similar age and very well recognised, both within their fields and to some degree.
And John Houghton's spoken here.
Has he? Oh, excellent.
But his brother lived just behind you.
Did he? Interesting. I did not know that, I promise. I did not know that. So it's an interesting thing. So you don't. Some of you will know more about him than me, easily. But he said, our science is God's science. So how can we deal with such differing views, and where does that come from? I want to start by just thinking what science is. And it's actually a much trickier thing to consider and think about than it might appear at first. People talk about science often as if it's some sort of simple, very well-formed and as if it's a single method. But the reality is science, the term and the practice, covers a multitude of different things. This is a Collins Dictionary definition. It says, the systematic study of nature and behaviour of the material and physical universe. The material and physical universe is what's been focused upon, and it's a study of that, and then the features that it says are observation, experiment, measurement, and the formulation of laws to describe these facts in general terms. And I think that's a nice description, because it tells you what the focus of science is, which is the material and the physical, and it tells you the things that constitute science. But you'll notice it doesn't just say experiment, it says observation, measurement, experiment. It's using multiple terms to give a bit of breadth. But we might say these are the typical activities that we get of science. We observe, we experiment, we theorize. And some sciences are more one thing than the other, and some are a mixture. Probably all experimental science is a mixture of all of them. But nevertheless, we have these three different things happening. And then the aim is to build the knowledge. And so we talk about the science on a specific subject. And what we mean by that is the mass scientific knowledge that's relevant to the topic that we're talking about. And so I just want to go through some of the different sciences. I won't bore you with all of them. There's actually a very large number, and depending on who you ask, they will subdivide for some time. But just to think about it and see how that helps us think about what science is. So this image on the right is one of Jupiter's moons, Io. And astronomy is the science that will look at things like a moon of Jupiter, or the sun, or the constellations, and the phenomenon that relate to them, and try and form some sort of knowledge body about them. And just to use as an example of how that can work, Olli Rohmer was the first person who made a quantitative estimate of the speed of light. Now, this was in the 17th century. He was one of the first people to theorize that the speed of light was actually finite, that it didn't just go everywhere immediately. And he made his theory on the basis of observations of the eclipse of Jupiter's moons, in particular Io, which he observed. And through observing it, he theorized that the speed of light would be finite, along with one of his kind of mentor that he worked with. He then went and made a series of observations, collected data to confirm his hypothesis. And this took a period of about 8 years to amass this data. And he came up with an estimate of the speed of light, not the value that we now use if you search in a textbook, but nevertheless, he was the first person to come up with an estimate and find a method to do that. So you see this pattern of observation, thinking about it, theorising, and then maybe collecting data and then testing things. If we move to chemistry, thinking about structures, properties of matter and the study of those, we could think about a discovery of nitrous oxide. Some of you will be familiar with what that is, but it was initially detected by Joseph Priestley, who just had an interest in gases. It doesn't seem that he was particularly interested for any practical reason. He just wanted and was part of a scientific community that wanted to observe. And he observed a number of gases, which in his lifetime he referred always to airs. So it's a bit confusing, the text, because he talks about different types of airs. But one of those, to him, airs, which to us are gases, was nitrous oxide. And he discovered it, was able to produce it. But he lost real interest in it and moved on to other areas. But later, other people came and discovered the property of nitrous oxide, which is better known as laughing gas. And this picture here is of an anesthetic machine. We now, technology has moved on to make it easier, but in the 19th century, laughing gas was used for the first time as an anesthetic for someone who had a tooth extracted. So the interesting thing here is you've got discovery, and then with no meaningful purpose at the time, but later someone comes on and finds a property of it, and then it's tailored to a property. And all of those things are scientific, in my eyes. Moving to a different area, epidemiology. This would be considered the study of diseases and populations. And an interesting, perhaps one of the most famous examples in epidemiology is about the cholera epidemic in London in the 19th century. Cholera is an infectious disease. It causes dehydration, potential death. And there was an outbreak, a number of outbreaks across the world in the 19th century, but one in particular was particularly bad in London, and within a space of about 10 days, 500 people died. And that clearly was provoking great concern. John Snow was the person who investigated it. There were theories about how cholera spread, but what he did was he found and marked on the map, which is shown up here, the locations of all of the deaths. I don't know how well you can see that, but these are streets in central London. This is Soho, Oxford Street's along the top. And then there's lots of little dots in black. These are the deaths, sites of the deaths. And there are crosses there, and the crosses are the water pumps. And what you can see, if you can see it carefully, is most of them are very close to this, where this star is. And that was the Broad Street water pump. And he theorised that that was the source of it. He persuaded the local officials to basically remove the handle from the pump. To stop people using the pump, the epidemic immediately disappeared. So here we see science in action, but in a very different way. There's a practical problem that's stimulating the discovery. He collected this data, he observed it, saw a pattern, theorised an alternative to what had been proposed an action, and then they saw the benefits straight away. And that's just the pump that moved in London. You can actually go and see it. And in the background is a pub, which I think is closer to the actual spot. The pump was originally in the pub, rather fittingly, is called John Snow. Moving quite differently to biology, we're talking about the science of living organisms. And here, part of biology is describing living organisms, but a large extent, increasingly so in modern science, is experimental biology. That's using experiments to discover new findings and to discover the interactions and properties, and much of that is focused towards medicine, but not exclusively. Examples of biology and the different kind of ways, probably the most famous original was Robert Hooke in the 17th century, and he used a microscope, which apparently Galileo had helped devise a better version of a microscope. He used that version and he used it to discover the presence of cells. First discovery. So just an observation that led to description of something that was a real step forward. In the 1950s, Watson and Crick, DNA had already been discovered, but there was uncertainty about its structure. They proposed, on the basis of some evidence, and basically trying out, as I understand it, different patterns, eventually proposed what's shown here, which is a double helix, which you'll tend to be familiar probably from seeing patterns like that, television and other various programs. And so there you have someone building on previous evidence, someone collecting some information but theorising and then testing it out. So what does science give us? And there's some examples here on the right that I'm giving here. Various things, medicine. I've got a selfie stick intentionally with a mobile phone because a mobile phone encapsulates many, many different scientific discoveries. But the selfie stick hints at something I want to go into later is there's a question about how you use that science as well, as opposed to just having it. And then for those who want some more domestic example, all the chemicals that we use to clean our houses and etc., they're all part produced by science. If you want to think of it a little bit more about a theory, you could say it's a way to correct the limitations in our senses to observe the world around us. And what it does, it seeks to be unbiased, quantify uncertainty and extend our perception. So the microscope's a good example. The cells are there, but you and I can't see them with our normal eye. But technology is harnessed to allow us to understand the world better. What it also does is it produces frameworks and theories to explain what's been observed. So we have fundamental laws of physics which help us understand what is and isn't possible and what we can achieve. And we have findings from experimental science which particularly allow us to understand how we interact with the world and what we can do and what it will cause something else. And so we've got achievements of discoveries, descriptions and theories related to the world and how it works. And then we have techniques and products coming from them that influence, enable us to influence the world. So it gives us very much, I hope you agree. But I would also say that it's something that science needs and can't provide of itself. So science tells us about the world around us. That's what it's aimed to do. So by definition, it doesn't try to go beyond that. That is, strictly speaking, what it's supposed to be about, and the only things that it can infer beyond that are those that can be reasonably inferred from an observation of a natural world. There are certain things that it presumes or assumes. You might say it presumes the understandability of the world. It's something we presume all the time when we go about our daily life. We presume we can interact with a cup. You know, you went and got a drink if you did. And you presume that you could do that physically. But that is a presumption that you have. And in terms of science, we broaden that and say, well, the way I describe things, I have a reasonable way that I can say something meaningful about the world that's around me. And I can do that on what I see, but I can also do that on things that are unseen. And that is a presumption. And you could argue, why should it be there? And a science, strictly speaking, science doesn't tell you that. It just tells you that it seems to make sense. We have lots of patterns about it. Another great assumption is about a regularity of the world, or that the patterns continue. The system is going to stay roughly as it has been. Or if it hasn't, we can understand what causes that. And that's another assumption we make. People often use it quite derogatively, I am just a number, or I don't want to just be a number. As a statistician, I don't like that phrase. I like to defend numbers. But the point is that there is power in you being a number because it says other people can tell you something useful about you. So in medicine, we all benefit all the time from the power of just being a number. In that, there are other people who are close enough to you that drugs were tested on and the information that came from their findings were useful to you. So actually, there's a lot of power from that, but it's an assumption that science makes. And why should we expect that to be true? And then beyond that, it needs a moral or philosophical or just some way to say how should science be done, when should it be done, and how should we apply the findings of science. So strictly speaking, science cannot be justified by science. We can do science, we can get findings from science, but you can't prove science with science. And in another way, perhaps more intuitively, science, strictly speaking, is amoral. It doesn't make judgments about things in a moral sense. One of the things that implies from that is that science can be divorced from the scientist. I've been reading in the last year a book about Einstein's greatest error, and it basically is an explanation about his life, but emphasising the fact that as well as his great discoveries, he also had a period where he denied other valid discoveries because it didn't seem to fit with him. And the argument of the book was it was about his temperament, and the thing that made him the great pioneer was also the thing that made him struggle accepting the discovery of someone else and accepting that he was basically wrong. And that just highlights the fact that science is limited by scientists. And scientists are like you and I, they're human beings. And what I'm trying to say here is not that science should be thrown away, but what I'm saying is science is not perfect, and no one should give the presentation that everything a scientist does is always right, and is always perfect, and always pure. And in my own area of field, it's a big and worrying aspect of our research is issues about conflict of interest, people getting paid by companies but not declaring that, other people self-promoting their findings so that findings that aren't as useful get too much prestige, other people copy them a bit more. There are some, not many, and again I don't want to say this is widespread, but there are people who have falsified their data because of this desire to be the great scientist and persevere. All of these things come from the limitation that humans are the people who are doing the science. And then perhaps more fundamentally, much more worrying, is science without restraint on its conduct can be horrific. Everyone is aware of some of the atrocities the Nazis conducted. That led to a greater emphasis on conduct of research being done in the right way. There's documents such as the Declaration of Helsinki, there's various versions, but it was really about trying to say, in medicine, how do we do research and how do we do it in a way that respects people, gives them the opportunity to have autonomy as a person, fairness about conduct across people, and how to do it in a way that minimises risk and maximises benefit to individuals. Nevertheless, there have been some, and not too distant future, some horrific examples. And one of the most infamous is what's called the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, which was in Alabama in America. It ran for about 40 years. There was a number of about 300 black Americans, poor Americans, who contracted syphilis. They were entered into the study. They were not told they had syphilis. They were not treated, even though it was a valid treatment, and they were studied over that period of time. Horrific harm caused to people for a scientific aim, because there was some value on a pure scientific level to study the natural history of syphilis and to do an experiment, but on a human level, a horrific event. And then beyond that, we have to think about how we apply scientific findings, and they need some sort of control or some sort of marker to help us understand how we do. And one that's, as a father of two young children and having gone through the experience, Hugh will also experience of being offered tests. The one that's always in my mind and has been in a bit of the press is about screening tests for Down syndrome and other diseases. Science helped us identify how to detect it, helps us to identify how to do tests, helps us to know how accurate these tests are. It doesn't tell you what you should do with the test result. It doesn't tell you whether you should go on it. Is 99% good enough accuracy? Is 1 in 100 errors good enough? Science doesn't tell you that. I want to very briefly now move to what is religion. I won't spend much time, and I'm thinking broadly here beyond Christianity, but we're talking about belief and worship of a superhuman controlling power, especially a god or gods. And the point to emphasise is not all are the same. There's not one religion, there's many. And there's a clear division between theistic and non-theistic. And that's important, I think, when we come later on towards thinking about some sort of agreement. There is also substantial variation between and within religions. So that has to be borne in mind. So when people make these bold statements, they're making quite a lot of assumptions about what they're comparing as well. What religion gives us or can give us, well, think in a very broad descriptive level, purpose for life in all its variety, and that can include science, as it could include any other activity such as washing the dishes or anything else you do. Can give us a framework for morality of action. And it can give us, I would argue, some philosophers would argue differently, can give you moral absolutes. If the religion is correct and the religion is trustworthy, then you can have a moral absolute. And then religion does not seek to provide a textbook for life, nor claim to be society. I was writing this and then I realised there was at least one exception, which is Scientology, which actually claims to be both science and religion and is quite exceptional, I think, in that way. Nevertheless, the statement above is generally right about most sciences. They're not aiming to give you a textbook for everyday life, and they're certainly not claiming to be science. So are science and religion compatible? And here again we find great contrast in statements. Steven Weinberg says, the world needs to wake up from the long nightmare of religion. Anything we scientists can do to weaken the hold of religion should be done. So the inference there is it's anti-science, and so it's a responsibility of anyone who practices science to exclude and try and get rid of religion. And then contrast that with Psalm 112, verse 2, great are the works of the Lord, they are pondered by all who delight in them. The idea that nature and everything around it points you towards God and is a reflection of God and who God is. And this one's interesting because this is an inscription that was above the Cavendish laboratory, which James Clerk Maxwell was involved with in the University of Cambridge. And James Clerk Maxwell was a very famous 19th century scientist, so famous that Einstein once said that it was more Clerk Maxwell than Newton that he really was building upon. And Clerk Maxwell had fundamental findings about electromagnetism and such like. But he wanted this. He was a very committed Christian, and he wanted this above the entrance of the laboratory. So are they compatible? Here are the two contrasting images. One suggests religion's for the bin. There's another one which I found which says faith triumphs over facts. There's somewhere in America. You could be a bit more generous to that reading. I think what it means is faith triumphs over life and obstacles and situations. I think that's what it means, but the people who took this picture and presented it saw it as very much religion rejects all sort of understanding and knowledge if it gets in the way of religion. And we've got a variety of views. It's not possible then to put these things together, or that's because science or religion's always right. There's little value in one of them. That would be the Richard Dawkins view, the God delusion, the dispose of it all, there's no value. There is Stephen Gould, who was a famous scientist, produced a bit more of a subtle nuanced view, which was calling non-overlapping magisteria. He said, well, science was about facts and religion's about values. And both of them in their own context have value and merit. But what he saw really was, I think, be fair to say that if there was any interaction, then you had to give in to science, was really where he was coming from. But a bit more respectful about the two, that there was some benefit. And then the view that I propose and come with, which is yes, but there are tensions to be addressed. So visually, we might think of science and religion here. This is knowledge here. And you might see them as non-overlapping. So there's knowledge from science, knowledge from religion. They've got nothing in common. However, most people, I think, would see it a bit more like this, with a red zone of conflict, or at least some sort of overlap and potential conflict. Others would see it as like this. Science is on the front, so it subsumes religion, or religion subsumes science. But can we maybe have this and then deal with some of these points of tension? And I'm going to go through three, I think, are more, to me, more prominent sources of tension, hopefully fairly briefly. So first, thinking about supernatural events, and maybe the problem here is quite well summed up by David Hume, who said quite a long time ago, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. So we have nature, we know the laws from science, you can't have a miracle because they go against it. And what we mean by supernatural here is the intervening of the divine in the normal life. So then can you reasonably have that if you observe a law and see a pattern? And there's no doubt there's been a historical change in thinking amongst communities, and we've certainly moved a long way from the period where people worshipped the weather patterns, and we had the weather gods of various kinds in various communities, and Thor probably is one of the more familiar names, the people, god of thunder, versus modern meteorology. Most people would not ascribe divinity to thunder in its own right, or worship the moon or the sun or such like. But can we have some sort of convergence? And I think we can still. Strictly speaking, science describes a process under the same conditions. So if the condition can change, then the law no longer holds. And so the point being that if there is supernatural or divine intervention, the point is that the normal process has now been altered. And therefore what normally happens is not what you presume will happen, because the presumption of applying the law is the circumstances the same. And I think, for me personally, there is evidence that science has produced that suggests things are not quite as stable as they might have appeared to be. And on the face of level, we think everything's going to be the same. Sun goes up, sun comes down, sun goes up, sun comes down. But science has actually pushed boundaries and shown us that the world has changed in quite remarkable ways over its period of time. So I think that, for me, also points to that it makes it more reasonable to understand the possibilities of things changing. Perhaps one of the most infamous areas of contention is evolution. And Roger Scruton, who some of you might have noticed passed away recently, who was a philosopher and quite respectful of some value in Christian or religious traditions, nevertheless said, "I have a scientific mind. I just can't dismiss the evidence of Darwinism. It's so obviously true." And what he meant by that is, I can't be a believer in God. Darwinism, that is evolution, and then his philosophical extension, is so true that I can't be anything else than an atheist. It's certainly true that Darwin's work in the 19th century, The Origin of Species, has created a bit of a revolution in the biological sciences. It's worth saying, what is the theory of evolution to understand it a bit better? It's not really a theorem or rule as we might understand mathematical theorems. It's actually a framework, and a framework that to some extent was altered since what he has proposed and been loosened by others to an extent. And there's also an issue about what we mean by the scope of evolution. Those who take the more strongest form of it, such as Richard Dawkins and others, would see evolution as the explanation of everything that you observe around. But others try and make more of a distinction between what we observe more closely in the smaller levels of variation, sometimes called microevolution, versus macroevolution, which is more explanations of all the variation in biological life that we observe, and particularly differences between major species groups. So what I want to think briefly about is, does it entail atheism? And for me, no, it doesn't. It would be worth acknowledging that if you were to accept evolution, then it will create tension for specific religious interpretation beliefs. Tensions not necessarily mean they're wrong, but just to point out that it will challenge in those areas. And is there scientific ground for scepticism about evolution? There are certain things that it presupposes and requires, and it's worth pointing out those are quite remarkable. Firstly, you need the right conditions, which we know from increasing studies is quite exceptional, the world that we have and how unique it is. They're also needed to be the material to start the process. If you presume evolution, you need to have the starting point, and a very rich, fertile starting point. If you want to use the analogy, you need very rich soil on which something to grow. And that does point to the fact that this concept of it being self-automated and everything going on by itself, for me anyway, personally, causes some doubts. And certainly in terms of the evidence, particularly the fossil evidence, has been less remarkable than probably has been anticipated. And to perhaps a lesser extent, but still true, I think, genetic and biodiversity has been somewhat disappointing to those who are passionate about evolution, in that it hasn't been the wholesale proof that it was anticipated there to be. So it comes to the point where we think, are inherent and environmental natural selection process sufficient? For me, I don't believe so. And maybe that's something we've discussed it towards the end, views on that. Are they compatible? The last area I want to think about is just about the study of the brain. And Malcolm Jeeves said the easy approach would be to say that all mental activity ultimately reduces to brain activity. The concept here is then brain activity reduces to things that you can observe in neurons and whatever, and ultimately saying that it's all basically a naturalistic explanation, therefore any religious belief has now been subsumed into biology in essence. What we do know increasingly is that the mind is dependent on the brain, and this physical manifestations and responses to stimulus. I was talking about anesthesia earlier on. You get knocked out, you're unconscious. There's lots of things that we accept quite naturally about that. But are we only a brain? And there's experiments that show physical signs and responses, but they don't explain thought. And there's various experiments which have shown that far too simplistic views about the brain are not true, whereas people are able to have consciousness without large chunks of their brain. People are able actually to have this understanding, which means that it's a much more complicated picture than just reducing it to the brain and saying it's all self-contained. And certainly a lot of philosophers and some scientists would say, no, you cannot reduce the mind to the brain. The mind is something that's greater than just what you would purely expect from physical symptoms. There is a whole kind of area which flows from evolution rethinking to try and say that various explanations, some say that it's just a hangover of the way that our brains have grown, that we are religious, others say it's a negative sort of virus, that was the Dawkins sort of view. The others say that it's actually been quite a positive thing for the survival and development of people, but nevertheless, it's something that's come from evolution and not thing. These are all interesting explanations, but strictly speaking, they're scientific speculations. They have not come from any experimental research. They are applying the theory of evolution to other parts of science, but in a very speculative manner. So for me, they are not at all persuasive. So bringing this to a close, the possibility for some sort of agreement, I think it's possible, but we'd have to accept that science has limits. For me, it does, and that's important to recognise. But if you think science is the only place for knowledge in town, then, such as Richard Dawkins, then there can be no agreement. I also think that you need a religious belief that values and respects knowledge, including scientific findings. If you don't have that, there cannot be any sort of intellectual agreement here. I think of compatibility here. I'm not saying, strictly speaking, there could be no single person who holds this belief and that belief, but could they be intellectually, coherently held together? And I think there's a number of areas that actually point increasingly towards coherence of them. I mentioned about the presumption of an intelligent and ordered world. If you come from certain religious traditions, and particularly a Christian tradition, you have a belief of a creator. That makes you very rationally think of a created world, one that has order, one that has structure, that's something we're naturally able to study. And many scientists, including many atheists, have highlighted the fact that the world seems, on initial looking, like it was designed. But it would be obviously quite easy to then say, well, it looks like it's designed because it is designed. Another strength could be that it provides honour and value and understanding. In fact, many of the pioneers of science were Christians, were passionate, along the lines of the psalm that I've already presented, that they were inspired by their faith. And scientific knowledge was valued in its own right. Not because it achieved and got you money or got you anything, but just as a virtue in discovery. And also, it also could be argued that if you come from a religious tradition where you accept the limitations of people, you see the value of systematic scientific study to try and go beyond our limitations, as opposed to just an argument about people's personal opinion. And then the last area where I think there has been some sort of movement towards agreement is the beginning of everything. Firstly, that there is a beginning, because for a period of time, many scientists held quite rigidly that everything that is always was. And then there's a fundamental shift through astronomy, chasing back to what's often called the Big Bang, that there was a singularity, and then the universe expanded from them. So there was a beginning, and if anyone has beliefs that point in towards the beginning, they naturally come together. What we also know about that beginning is it's exceptionally surprising that we are here, because there's a number of laws which, if they were slightly different by a very small amount, such as the pull of gravity, life would never have existed in its current form, and the materials that were needed for that beginning. So there's various things that point to the unlikelihood of that. Now, people who come from an atheistic point of view have counter-arguments, but they're also, again, in this region of speculation, not scientific evidence. So, concluding thoughts, I think science and religion can be compatible. I would go further and say, in principle, they are, because they're trying to do different things. And the history of science is dotted with prominent religious scientists. Newton, Mendel, who's famous for pioneer of genetics, modern genetics. Kelvin, Lord Kelvin, a good Scottish scientist, if I'm able to be biased. Houghton, who I've just mentioned, a living scientist. They're religious men. It was a big part of who they were, and they felt it was part in keeping of what they did. It doesn't mean that it's proof per se, but it does make you think. These are not idiots who were able to be active religious people, in these cases Christians of various persuasions, and they were very much successful and important scientific pioneers. Not all varieties of science and religion can be resolved, and if we are going to resolve, we do have some tensions. And what I worry is that some of these ease and some heighten over time. And I think the beginning of the world is one where it's lessened over time. There are other ones which are still very much the hot topics, but maybe they will ease somewhat over time. Who can say where science will go and what some of the findings might be? And it's an area that intelligent and educated people have.